Now, we have discovered from looking at the first sign of these seven signs that they're interspersed with seven discourses or conversations and seven I ams, the sayings that John uses. So we get the impression that John likes the number seven. A fact not lost in us, as in the weeks we have been going through the book of Revelation, seven keeps on cropping up. It's a symbolic number of completeness. So in this case, of the seven signs, it presents a watertight argument of what these seven signs tell us about Jesus. By the time we have got to this second sign, quite a lot has happened. Jesus had the conversation with Nicodemus. He has been to Jerusalem and cleansed the temple, then gone back to Galilee from Judea via Samaria, talked to the woman at the well, spent some time with the Samaritans, talking, teaching, eating, and living with them, which was a very unholy thing for a holy man to do. And now he is back in Galilee, precisely where his ministry began for John, in his explanation and examination of the purpose and person of Jesus, and as a prophet in coming back to the one-horse hick town of Cana in Galilee, like Georgia, Alabama, and Rosa Parks on the bus that we thought about before. But this time it's like Jesus having coming back from Washington, D.C., where he created a storm. John began his gospel by staking out his claim. He said the Word became a human being full of grace and truth and lived among us. We saw his glory, which he received as the Father's only Son. So unlike Luke, who put together an orderly account from a whole variety of vetted sources and perspectives for Dear Theophilus, John is an eyewitness, the disciple who Jesus loved, who puts together his own very focused account of Jesus from a lifetime of teaching and preaching to skeptical Jews, uncertain converts to Judaism in the diaspora, and the Greek-speaking intelligentsia. The key cumulative bits of evidence to demonstrate the fact that underlines who Jesus is and the purpose he lays out in John 20, which says the disciples, in his disciples' presence, Jesus performed many other miracles that are not written in this book, but these have been written in order that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and through your faith in him you may have life. This sign is therefore about miracles with a meaning, the next step beyond water into wine. In the first miracle, Jesus has shown himself as the giver of joy, a foretaste of the messianic banquet and the cleansing of the temple. He declares himself to be the new temple, the true place of meeting between God and his people. To Nicodemus, he has revealed himself as the giver of new birth from above. To the people of Samaria, he has become known as the Saviour of the world. And now to this nobleman, he was revealed as the giver and preserver of life from the dead. And commentators are split on what 44 means when Jesus says a prophet is not respected in his own country. As to what exactly it means when he refers to his own country, particularly as it says the Galileans welcomed him because they had been at the recent Passover festival, which had also included miraculous signs and wonders. Jesus was famous. He was a religious celebrity. Nicodemus' opening gambit for conversation earlier was, "Rabbi, we know you are a teacher who has come from God, for no one could perform the miraculous signs you are doing if God were not with him." And before this, in John chapter 2, he records, "Now while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, many people saw the miraculous signs and believed in his name." But what actually did this belief consist of? And this is the crux question answered by this second sign, identified by John, because even as Jesus' fame was built by these works of power, John tells us in chapter 2, Jesus did not trust himself to them because he knew them all. Which may go some way to explaining in verse 48, when we get to it, the reason why the foot-weary nobleman, having traveled 20 miles in the heat of the day, is sharply rebuffed and given a short, abrupt answer in response to his son's plight. And one might even say Jesus was rude in the circumstances. Before that, we remind ourselves about one aspect of the ministry of Messiah, and that is a prophet. But it's also bundled with the perfect priest and king rolled into one person that the Jews were expecting. And we looked at last time, there was a whole host of other things they had failed to understand and anticipate who the Messiah was going to be. But the role of the prophet particularly relates to the high esteem in which Moses was held. And in Deuteronomy, Moses writes, "In the land you are about to occupy, people follow the advice of those who practice divination." Now in the media, it was reported that a psychic sea turtle predicted Brazil's win against Croatia, for instance. So nothing's new in that regard. Prediction which actually came true. Well, there we go. But also look for omens. "To the Lord, your Lord, your God, does not allow you to do this. Instead, he will send you a prophet, like me, from among your own people, and you are to obey him." Now, Moses faced a criticism within his own family, open rebellion, attacks on his personal life. There were rumblings, grumblings, murmurings, bitter opposition. At times, they were ready to stone him, they tried to sack him, they tried to bypass him and replace him. So, a funny kind of obedience, but not unusual. What was unusual is when they actually did what a true prophet actually said. Indeed, one of the most startlingly successful prophets in these terms was a contemporary of poor old Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, who saw his warnings cut piece by piece and fed into a royal brazier by Israel's last king, Zedekiah. He was thrown into a dry cistern to die. He was put in stocks and he was put in prison. Even with Jerusalem in pieces and his prophecies proved right in appalling detail, they still refused to listen. Even in the post-apocalyptic ruins and chaos of a Babylonian victory, and after the murder of the puppet governor Gedaliah, the surviving elements of the army and the people of every class came to Jeremiah and asked him to find out from God what to do. "Show us," they asked, "the way we should go and what we should do." And God graciously does so. And the choice is between life and death. It's as simple as that. Because the people fear the Babylonian response to the murder of the man they put in charge. And God says, "If you're willing to go on living in this land, then I will build you up and not tear you down. Stop being afraid. That if you are determined to go and live in Egypt, the war you fear, and we've been thinking about fearing war today, the war you fear will overtake you. You will die there in Egypt. So it was a straight choice. Guess what they did? True faith is rooted not in asking for advice in desperate circumstances, but the pattern of obeying what God says in the normal circumstances of life. So that's what makes the prophet Huldah all the more remarkable. During a belated restoration project in the temple, a book is found. It's so long since anyone has read it, they don't initially realise what it was. When the king gets to read it, he is appalled as he realises how far the Jewish nation has fallen from what it was intended to be as God's covenant people, and that it has fallen for a very long time. He commissions the top priests and court servants to consult the Lord for him and for all the peoples of Judah. So they do. They go to the prophet Huldah, living in the newer part of Jerusalem. And the answer comes back, judgment and punishment are coming. But because of the king's attitude, they won't come until after his death. In 2 Kings 22 verse 20, we hear God's promise, I will let you die in peace. And the whole of chapter 3 details the wholesale reforms Josiah took that were unprecedented in Jewish history for the whole of the monarchy period. And it culminated in the reinstitution of the Passover. And we read in 2 Kings 23, no Passover like this had ever been celebrated by any of the kings of Israel or Judah, that includes David, since the time when the judges ruled the nations. But the reforms didn't last, and Josiah's life ended on the battlefield in an ill-judged military campaign. The name of Huldah is unusual for an Old Testament prophet because it is feminine, and it is due to the fact that she was a woman. At her word from God, the king obeyed to an astonishing degree. And at that level, she remains one of the most successful prophetic ministries in the age of the monarchy. But this is in contrast to poor Jeremiah, her contemporary, who dies years later in Egypt. Faithful to the end, but legend has it he was stoned to death in his 70s by his own people. But he was the more usual track record for a prophet, as Stephen recalls in Acts 7 before being murdered by a mob. How stubborn you are! How heathen your hearts! How deaf to God's message! Was there any prophet that your ancestors did not persecute? They killed God's messengers who long ago announced the coming of his righteous servant. You are the ones who receive God's law that was handed down by angels, and you have not obeyed it. And in Hebrews, listed among the large crowd of witnesses of faith, are these from verse 35. Others refused to accept freedom, died under torture in order to be raised to a better life. Some were mocked and whipped. Others were put in chains and taken off to prison. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. Reputedly what happened to the prophet Isaiah. They were killed by the sword. They went around clothed in skins of sheep or goats. Poor, persecuted and ill-treated. The world was not good enough for them. They wandered like refugees in the desert and the hills, living in caves, holes in the ground. Now, I have to ask you, with a career path like that, would you want that job? So when Jesus comments, a prophet is not respected in his own country, perhaps this is something of an ironical understatement. The bite of this will deepen intensely after the third sign. But here we are in Cana, in Galilee, and in walks a nobleman. The Greek is basilikos. It means one officially attached to the service of a king, a basileus. And it was probably Herod Antipas, although technically he was just a tetrarch, not a true king, but appointed in place by the Romans. But he made sure that most others under his jurisdiction saw him as a king. He has walked 20 miles. That's a long way uphill from Capernaum on the shore of Lake Galilee to the hill town of Cana. He has not come on a whim. He has come because he is desperate. He has heard the stories, and just perhaps this carpenter from Nazareth might be able to help. And he humbles himself by coming in broad daylight amongst the king's subjects, unlike Nicodemus as a member of the Sanhedrin, who came by night. And he comes to this miracle worker who is already politically controversial, and by publicly associating with him and asking his help, puts his own position and livelihood at risk. But this does not dissuade him from asking, "Sir, come with me before my child dies." Pleading, asking for Jesus to go back with him the 20 miles to Capernaum, where his son lies dying, because he believes that Jesus can save him, can heal his son. It's a picture of pathos. Believes in desperation. It's a father's desperation, a father's determination to do everything possible and within his power for his son. And in reply, Jesus rebuffs him. He says, "None of you will ever believe unless you see miracles and wonders." It is interesting that the word here for wonders is teras, and it's used only here in this gospel and in this context. And it is a sweeping rebuke addressed to the Galileans at large that their welcome was flawed, founded on too much interest in the razzmatazz they associated with raw miracles themselves, which was actually spiritually dangerous, that did not encourage genuine faith, and implicitly too is included the nobleman as to what were the real reasons for his coming. But the nobleman, like the Syrophoenician women in Mark chapter 7 and Mary being rebuffed earlier at the wedding party, is not put off. He is not interested in the finer elements of the nature and form of the Messiah or the true nature of prophecy itself, but the well-being of his child. He persists. And this highlights the difference of the mentality of the majority, the desire for novelty and showmanship, and the rightly directed but inadequately developed faith of the nobleman. He's not a theologian and probably not a religious person. He is not silenced by this rebuff, but pushes on and persists. A man of action, expecting action. "Sir, come with me before my child dies." He wants action. And Jesus gives him action. "Go, your son will live." Like the centurion asking for the healing of his servant in Matthew chapter 8 and Luke chapter 7, as a person used to giving orders and running a household of servants, he recognizes the word of authority. He doesn't get what he asked for, but without a further word, he turns on his heels and goes. Although that must have been hard to retrace his step, and go home with the simple assurance that his son lives. The man believed, we read, Jesus' word and went. But he is not simply interested, unlike his fellow Galileans, in the circus of signs and wonders. He has been urging Jesus to come to Capernaum, thinking at least Jesus needed to be there. But what he has got is a stiffer test of his faith than that of the centurion who requested Jesus not to bother visiting his house to heal his servant, but just to say the word. And although Jesus was willing to go and indeed was on his way, here the nobleman has nothing but Jesus' bare word. He believes and he goes. The servants he bumps into tells him that the fever has gone, and it broke about 1 o'clock, the exact time that Jesus had spoken these words. And in simple trust and obedience, he had gone home in faith. We are told 3 times the boy lives. Your boy is going to live, by the servants, and by Jesus earlier in verse 50, your son will live. And the father reflecting and digesting the news, remembering what and when Jesus has said, your son will live. He had believed it from Jesus. The servants had confirmed it. Now he had seen it for himself. Both the centurion's healing and this miracle had been at a distance. And the result here was, recorded by John, so he and all his family believed. It was not simply a case of someone who got out of Jesus what they wanted and then simply forgot about it. And that did happen sometimes. But somebody who embraced a deeper, more informed and disturbed faith, learning by obedience to what Jesus had commanded, the Anointed One of God, the Moses-like prophet. It is true belief because it is based on the word of Jesus and at the same time obedience to that word. That does not mean now as then God is no longer in the business of miracles, but it does mean we need to put them in their proper place. So this leads us to a very pedestrian fact. Hearing is not enough. Seeing and experiencing God's work in our midst is not enough. Novelty is not enough. Variety and curiosity and being favourably inclined is not enough. Faith leads to obedience. The nobleman learns this, that the word of Jesus, indeed, is a word of authority. The authentication of his trust in Jesus leads his son to life and his whole household into the fullness of faith in Jesus, as John understands the term. And the second sign is like the wedding, a request arising from ordinary human need, a rebuff, an order given, an order obeyed, which then people saw as a result Jesus' glory. And these signs can enable us to go forward in the path of faith. But contrast this with the Samaritans, who saw no miracles, but these foreigners leapt from nationalistic arguments over Jews and Samaritans to conclude, we ourselves have heard him. We know that he really is the saviour of the world. They, the nobleman, the centurion, recognised the authority of Jesus, and that gave them the confidence to obey, to trust, to put their faith into practical action. Jesus granted Thomas's request to meet, greet, and examine the resurrected Jesus because he missed it the first time and refused to believe without it. But Jesus' conclusion was this: do you believe because you see me? How happy are those who believe without seeing me? There are whole industries offering advice, guidance, as manipulation for you to listen to their authority to shape the choices you make, the way you spend your money, the priorities in life you set. Faith in Messiah, Prophet Jesus, means simply obeying what he taught. It does not require desperate circumstances, though often it is only when we are driven to that we begin to change our minds, but disciplined application of what Jesus said, the word. That is what deepens our faith and trust. Obedience to what Jesus taught. Not our ability to have heard and be immersed in Christian church and culture and its rhythms, responsibilities or routines or even study, but our commonplace discipline in living out in obedience what Jesus taught us in what makes for life. God gave the law through Moses, wrote John. Grace and truth come through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. The only Son, who is the same as God and is at the Father's side, he has made him known. Are you listening? Really listening?